Happy to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. A little bit later on in the program, we'll be along about 11:45 or so, we'll be talking about patents and trademarks and copyrights and licensing agreements. There's a new book out. It's called The Independent Investor's Handbook, and we'll have a chance to visit with one of the authors of that book at 11:45 today as we talk about inventions. Have you got an idea for an invention? If you do, well, tell you what, you want to patent it, you better listen in. And I tell you what, it's a very entertaining book, and I'm really pleased to be able to talk with one of the authors, Gilbert Wellytalk, a little bit later on in the program. To begin the program today, though, we're going to be talking with you about Alzheimer's disease. My mother died from Alzheimer's and was sick for, went from diagnosis to death. It was probably about 7 years or so. And fortunately for our family, my sister was able to care for her. But I think, from time, it's been about 10 years ago now. In that time, there have been a lot of advancements, and certainly it's something we want to talk about with our guest today, the advancements in Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Mark Sager, we don't have him with us yet, but he'll be soon with us by telephone, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He works out of Madison, will be our guest as soon as we are able to get him online to be able to talk about treatment of Alzheimer's disease. And I know we're going to get him pretty quickly here. So if you want to join in at some point, you are certainly welcome to do that. Email us at talk@wpr.org. That's one way to do it. But he, along with one of his colleagues, has published a research paper, Dave Weimer, also from the University of Wisconsin, assessed the disease and have published recently a research paper that was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia, that particular publication, and talks about how we could save billions of dollars actually in costs down the road if we were able to diagnose and treat Alzheimer's early. Early diagnosis and treatment of Alzheimer's is really what needs to be done. At one point, we didn't think there was, once you have Alzheimer's, the thought was, well, there wasn't much that could be done about it. And frankly, for many, many years, there wasn't anything much that could be done other than just sort of make the person's life more comfortable. In my own case, in my own family's case, we were very fortunate in that my sister was able to come home and spend time with my mother. So my mother got to spend the last 5-6 years of her life at her own home with loving family members around her to see to her needs. And it was really a tough time for our family, and I'm sure that many of you have had somewhat similar kinds of experiences when you have a loved one with Alzheimer's. It's a very, very, very hard on the family, and obviously very hard on the person with the Alzheimer's. Although my mom seemed to be pretty comfortable most of the time. So I was really pleased when we had a chance to get Dr. Mark Sager to be with us by phone, and he is with us right now, so we'll have him join us. You may want to join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. And certainly, if you would like to join us, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Mark Sager with us by phone. Hi, Dr. Sager.
Well, how are you? I apologize for the delay.
Oh, that's all right. No problem. We're happy to have you with us right now. You recently published a paper stating that we could save as a nation billions of dollars in costs. And also, I think help our patients who have Alzheimer's with early diagnosis and treatment.
Yes. The state of practice right now is usually to wait until someone has significant symptoms before the diagnosis is made. And as a result, people are diagnosed at advanced stages of brain failure. Now, one way to think about Alzheimer's disease is that it is a stage of brain failure. As a result, many people require long-term care, especially expensive nursing home care. And the paper, it basically says that if we could identify people long before their brain begins to fail and they have symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, and if we could support their caregivers, we could delay entry into nursing home by many years and save money.
And, you know, Marion Madison is online with a question that I think I was going to ask following up. So let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
And thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I just ran into a friend who's about 50 years old, and he had sadly explained that he had early onset Alzheimer's. And I just wondered if we had talked to the doctor about the signs and symptoms to look for early onset Alzheimer's.
There are two forms of Alzheimer's disease. One is the late onset Alzheimer's disease that tends to occur in people in their 70s and 80s and is the most common. The early onset type of Alzheimer's disease has a very strong genetic link and occurs in people in their 40s and 50s. The symptoms are very similar. It tends to be loss of memory for recent events, confusion, disorientation. Some people begin to have word-finding difficulty, in other words, have problems completing a sentence. So the symptoms of early onset are very similar to the late onset variety, except for the age of onset.
Okay. And so are these things that, I mean, how do you watch for these things in your own family members?
Usually, first of all, it's important to know what's normal. What's normal is that we all tend to forget things, but it tends not to affect our ability to go to work, to function in everyday life, and also it's not progressive. And when forgetfulness is progressive, is getting worse, and when it begins to affect our ability to function at work, then that's time to be alarmed and to see a clinician and to have it evaluated.
Okay. Doug in Mount Horeb has a question for your comment. Doug, hi.
Hi. Great program. Thank you.
Sure.
I wonder if the doctor could tell us more about the differences and similarities between dementia and Alzheimer's, particularly dementia and late-onset Alzheimer's. My mom has what has been variously described by several physicians at age 86 as dementia, but others also say she has late onset Alzheimer's, and it's never quite clear to me what the difference is and what the pathways are for those. And also, if the doctor could refer us to any kinds of tests that people can take themselves to self-diagnose where they're at. My mom was given several. The mini mental state exam and some other ones, and just to amuse myself, I took them, and I'm 60 and very alert, but there were questions on there like, do you know what time it is and you know what day it is, and I didn't know either one at the moment, so I thought, well, I don't know how good these tests are anyway, so those are my questions. Thanks.
All right, thank you for calling.
Sure. The difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease is really terminology. Dementia is the general term, and it refers, for example, there are lots of causes of dementia, and Alzheimer's disease is the most common. One way to think about this, a heart disease is a very general term, but atherosclerotic heart disease, which is the most common cause of heart attacks, is a very specific term for a type of heart disease. Alzheimer's disease or late-onset Alzheimer's disease is a very specific cause of dementia. There are other causes of dementia, could be stroke, could be what we call Lewy body dementia, other Huntington's chorea, a lot of other diseases that affect the brain. So the difference is dementia is the general term, and Alzheimer's disease is the most common cause of dementia. The question about testing is interesting because usually a lot of the tests, such as the mini mental status exam mentioned by the caller, are designed for average audiences. In other words, the average person should be able to pass the mini mental status exam. Many people who are many scientists, for example, who win Nobel Prizes will pass the mini mental status exam, and yet could actually have substantial declines in memory and function as a result of Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. We tend to screen persons with different kinds of tests. One of them that we are using commonly is to ask people to name as many animals as they can in 60 seconds. Now, you may say, name as many animals as you can in 60 seconds, and that's a test of my memory. It seems that this particular test is very easy to do, can be administered by anyone, and believe it or not, is a fairly good indicator of cognitive problems such as dementia. Now, I'm not going to tell the listeners this cutoff score, but there are norms and cutoff scores for the number of animals you can name. What happens? Listeners might also think, well, gee, if I knew that I was going to be asked to name as many animals as I could, I would practice, and so that when I went in to see my doctor, I could name as many animals as possible. However, one of the problems with Alzheimer's disease is the inability to learn. So if you had Alzheimer's disease, you could practice all you want and still never get more than a certain number.
Oh, very, very interesting. And I wonder how many people are like me running animals' names through their heads right now.
the state of Wisconsin is using that as a screen.
Oh,
and we use it at the university.
Doug, thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, appreciate your call and question. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Talking with Dr. Mark Sager, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, giving us an update on Alzheimer's disease and dementia as we talk with him. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Dr. Mark Sager, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute today as we visit with him about Alzheimer's disease. Someone wondered about if you suspect a family member or friend has Alzheimer's, how do you get them tested? How do you get them in to get tested?
That's a good question, because many people who have memory problems are not aware that they're having difficulties. And one way to think about it is that someone who is forgetful many times will forget that they have forgotten. And so you can confront a parent or a spouse, and they say, "No, I'm just fine. There's just absolutely I'm having no difficulty whatsoever." And usually, it takes more than one family member to convince someone like that they need to be evaluated. And frequently in our memory clinic at University Station, we'll have entire families come with an affected spouse or affected parent. And it's kind of like the family says, we need to do something about this, and that's how it gets done. Many times, though, we have people who absolutely are, again, believe they have no problem and refuse.
Tell us a little more about your memory clinic. What's its purpose and how does it function?
What we do is provide two things that you normally cannot get in a typical office visit, and that is that we do neuropsychological testing to test the memory in the mind, and then we also provide a social worker who can talk to the family and the patient and deal with a lot of the issues that come up with people who are having memory problems. It's an interdisciplinary approach. Obviously, in addition to the test testing and social worker assistance. We have clinicians who are experts in the area of diagnosing dementing disorders who also see the patient. One of the things we have done at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute is to try to develop, and we have developed, numerous dementia diagnostic centers around the state. And in fact, there are approximately 30 dementia diagnostic centers around in Wisconsin that are affiliated with us and also provide similar types of services.
Hmm. Is the Alzheimer's disease, has it, it's always been with us, or does it seem to be much more prevalent now than, say, 25 years ago?
Well, it's more prevalent because we're living longer.
Okay.
And because this is a disease that is diagnosed in people in their 70s or 80s primarily, as long as we didn't survive to 70 or 80, this disease was not a problem.
Okay.
And but as we're living longer, it's becoming much more prevalent because more people are having symptoms and surviving longer.
Let's go to Scott in Milwaukee next. Scott, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, are there things you can do to lessen or prevent the onset of this? You hear about these mind games that are designed to keep you sharp and to motivate certain parts of the mind and the brain to help offset some of this stuff from occurring. Is there any science behind this stuff that it does actually work?
That's a very good question. First of all, there is no doubt that cognitive activity, diet, exercise, stress reduction are important factors that influence a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And so is Alzheimer's disease potentially preventable? I'm not sure we can say it's preventable, but we can certainly reduce one's risk and hopefully delay the onset. There is very good data, scientific data, to suggest that midlife stress reductions, exercise, a little bit of red wine, a whole host of things that can be done to reduce one's risk. The problem becomes is that there's not a lot of solid evidence that many of these mind games that you can purchase or that are advertised actually will reduce a person's risk of developing the disease. Many of these games focus on certain aspects of cognitive function, of brain function, and short-term may have some benefit, but long-term may not. And so the question is, you know, I'm sure there is a lot of money being made selling these devices and programs, but not a lot of science to support it.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Ann in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Doctor. I'm wondering if you had ever taken or made any tests on tobacco and Alzheimer's, because I know a lot of smokers and I have never met and I can never point out a smoker who developed Alzheimer's. And I know it might be an oxymoron to say to avoid Alzheimer's, smoke tobacco, but it's a fact. I'm just stating a truth. I just wonder if there could be tests made on that particular point, and maybe there's some kind of something that tobacco has that activates and keeps that certain part of the brain activated. So
I am not aware of any scientific evidence that nicotine or tobacco smoking is protective for Alzheimer's disease. It's very possible that smokers, especially heavy smokers, don't live long enough to develop the disease because of other complicating factors, whether it's lung cancer, whether it is increased risk of stroke, an increased risk of heart disease. So the answer is I'm not aware of any connection between cigarette smoking and Alzheimer's disease, and there may be a reason why smokers don't develop Alzheimer's disease, and it's that they have other diseases that occur.
Okay. Thanks, Ann, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Beth and Racine a chance to get on. Beth, hello to you.
Hi, good morning. Thanks
good morning.
For taking my call.
Sure.
My dad has Alzheimer's disease, and he's 82, and he has been in a nursing home, and I wanted to ask the doctor What I'd like to ask you what your experience has been with the drug risperidone and its administration to patients, elderly patients with Alzheimer's disease.
Yes. Risperidone is an antipsychotic, and it's one of many antipsychotics that have been used in the past to control problem behaviors in people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. There is no good evidence that, in spite of the use of these drugs, that these drugs actually do improve behavior or control problem behaviors in Alzheimer's patients. Most recently, there has been evidence to suggest that the use of not just risperidone, but other antipsychotics actually increase the risk of death in persons with Alzheimer's disease or other dementias. So in general, we try to avoid them as much as possible. And because there are side effects and questions about efficacy.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you very much for taking my call, and thanks for bringing this topic on the line. I appreciate it.
All right, Beth. Thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in with your question as well. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Jennifer in Oconomowoc next. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
My mom has early onset Alzheimer's. She's 66 years old, and it's really in the early stages. My dad has taken her to their family physician, where they've had to ask to get put on the prescription of Aricept, and I guess I feel like the family physician is just not the right person to be going to. So who should we go see? What kind of specialist should we take her to get a real diagnosis and get going on helping her?
In general, I would recommend a neurologist, neurology, a person specialized in neurology, are trained specifically in the diagnosis and differential diagnosis of dementing disorders. Someone who's also trained in geriatrics is very familiar with persons with dementia and would also be eminently qualified. So, but there are also many family physicians who are knowledgeable, and but not everyone. And I would recommend at least first going to your family physician, and then getting a referral to a knowledgeable neurologist or geriatrician.
Jennifer mentioned the drug Aricept. What is it?
Yeah, Aricept is the drug that's most commonly used in treating persons with Alzheimer's disease. Aricept, or donepezil, is a class of drugs that's designed to increase the concentration of a drug called acetylcholine in the brain. Now, acetylcholine has been found to be, the concentrations of acetylcholine are low in Alzheimer's disease, and it's also a drug that's very important in memory. And so the class of drugs, Aricept is one of them, Razadine is another, Exelon is another drug. All of those drugs are designed to increase the concentration of acetylcholine and provide some symptomatic improvement in memory.
All right. Jennifer, thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate your call. Kathy in Lodi, we're on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning.
Morning. What can we do for you?
Well, I have two questions, actually. First of all, does sleep apnea have any effect on the tendencies towards Alzheimer's?
Yes, it does. And what happens with sleep apnea, there have been studies looking at people with sleep apnea, and people with sleep apnea have obviously stopped breathing while they're sleeping, and as a result, the levels of oxygen decline and can damage the brain. And so people with sleep apnea do have an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease.
And how about the use of hormone replacement therapy, whether it be progesterone, estrogen, any of those, especially in women?
That's a good question, because it's a topic of it's a controversial topic for a couple of reasons. One is that estrogen is very important for the brain. Estrogen is involved in glucose metabolism, which is what the brain uses for energy. Estrogen is involved in the maintenance of the brain, the repair of damaged cells. So estrogen has many beneficial effects in the brain. And, of course, if that's true, the question becomes why, how can men compete? Because it's women who have the estrogen. And the reason, the answer to that question is that in men, testosterone is converted to estrogen in the brain. And so it is, and so estrogen, as I said, has been a very important topic of research. The problem with estrogen, especially the supplements that many women take, is that they're metabolized, those supplements are metabolized by the liver, and some of the byproducts of that metabolism increase the risk of blood clots. And so when the federal government instituted a major national study, the Women's Health Study, to evaluate the protective effect of estrogen in Alzheimer's disease, they actually began to find that many women taking these supplements had an increased risk of developing dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And the reason for that was that they were, and the hypothesis was that these byproducts from the metabolism of estrogen were increasing blood clots that were then going to the brain and causing small strokes. So we do not recommend that women take estrogen supplements to protect against Alzheimer's disease. There is some evidence, though, that estrogen taken around menopause, immediately after menopause, may be protective in some women. And we don't understand why that's the case, but as a rule, we do not recommend that women take estrogen and with the thought of preventing Alzheimer's disease.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much for calling, Kathy. Thea in Milwaukee, we're turning to you now. Hi, Thea.
Good morning. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have two questions. The first one is a two-part question. It's please describe multi-infarct dementia and then tell me how it's different from Alzheimer's or the same as Alzheimer's. And the second question is, tell me how I can find the location of or locations of the centers for dementia diagnosis that the Institute has in Wisconsin.
Sure. First of all, multi-infarct dementia refers to a dementia that is caused by multiple strokes. And strokes cause what we call infarction or death of the brain. And so someone who has multiple strokes will have multi-infarct dementia. The difference between multi-infarct dementia and Alzheimer's disease is that in Alzheimer's disease, we do not see evidence for stroke, but we do see evidence for the deposition of certain proteins in the brain, what are called amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Now, some patients will actually have what we call mixed dementia, which will have mean they'll have evidence for stroke, and at the same time will have evidence for Alzheimer's disease. But they're very distinct diseases with very different causes. Now, the question was also how can you identify or locate a dementia diagnostic center affiliated with the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, and that's simply to go to our the website, which is medsch, and then .wisc.edu/WAI. I'll go through that again. medsch.wisc.edu/WAI. And they're all listed there.
Okay, and I have one question that just came up in my mind, and that is, how do you diagnose Alzheimer's? Is it through an MRI, and can you also diagnose it, the multi-infarct dementia the same way?
Yes. The diagnosis of multi-infarct dementia is based upon a history of stroke or a sudden onset of symptoms and is confirmed by an MRI that will show evidence for strokes. The diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease is different in the sense that we would not expect to find abnormalities, distinct diagnostic abnormalities on an MRI, but we do get a very distinct history, and the history is usually one of slow progression, short-term memory loss that is getting worse and eventually beginning to affect someone's ability to function. And we do a variety of other tests to make sure that the person doesn't have potentially other explanations for their memory problems. Other explanations might be a low thyroid condition, might be diabetes, might be low vitamin B12, a whole host of things that can mimic or look like Alzheimer's disease when in fact they're not. So the MRI is very important in the multi-infarct dementia. It tends less to be less important in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Thea, for calling. Someone else emailed and wondered if you could summarize the results from your study and your research and your recent paper.
I assume that they're referring to the publication about the benefits of early diagnosis, early intervention, and the cost savings. Basically, what the analysis shows, and I should acknowledge Professor David Weimer, who is works with the La Follette School and is a professor, at the UW, who did some very sophisticated analysis that are that really compose the bulk of this publication. But basically, it says is that early intervention, early support for caregivers, and anything, whether it's a drug or a non-pharmacologic treatment that slows progression of the disease, has the potential to keep people at home and out of the long-term care system where, as we know, nursing home care and even care in assisted living and is very expensive. And so given the fact that Alzheimer's patients are at extremely high risk of entering nursing homes, at some, especially near the end of their lives, anything that would slow the progression and allow them to stay at home has the potential to save a lot of money.
Connie and Oshkosh, we turn to you now. Hi, Connie.
Hi there. Following what was just said, my father was in a nursing home because his Alzheimer's had periods of violence in him. And he got into the nursing home through having a small stroke. The hospital said, you know, he just couldn't come home. At home, we could not even get him out of the house to go to the doctor for any treatment, testing, et cetera. So it was a godsend that he had the small stroke. We visited him every day in the nursing home. Mother would hold his hand. He just wanted to lay and sleep. But he liked to listen to Mother and I talk about family things, and Mother liked to sit there and hold his hand. So it was a very enjoyable experience. He had violent periods where he would not allow the nurses to bathe him for 1 week, 2 weeks at a time, and they'd end up having to give him happy pills to mellow him out, to get him to be agreeable, to do just routine care. So that's why one of the other reasons the nursing home was so wonderful for him. And we would visit him about an hour before mealtime. And then we'd say, oh, it's time for dinner. And then we would take him in his walker or his wheelchair later on and take him to the dining room and get him set at the table with his bib, his terry cloth, garment protector, and then we would say goodbye and leave. So we didn't have any traumas on a daily basis leaving him there, although in the early months he did say he'd want to come home, and then we'd just kind of ignore those remarks from him. But if you have an Alzheimer's member of the family who has any amount of violence, even on a sporadic basis, they really need to be in a 24-hour facility where care can be given. That's just too much for a family to manage at home. And don't be guilty if your family member is in that state and you have to put them in a nursing home.
I agree, and I think that one of the more common reasons for someone with Alzheimer's disease to enter a nursing home is a behavior. And because the behavior obviously affects everyone in the family. It can be very disruptive. Caregivers lose sleep. But the goal, and I think the ultimate goal of this, of the research that's going on and the efforts that are being made, is to hopefully slow the disease so that people don't get to a point where behavior, problem behaviors become an issue. And I think that that's the future, but it's not the reality today. And I have to, the caller, I really have to applaud, because I know that that she and her family have went through quite a bit, and we see that on a regular basis. We see a lot of families who are very heroic and take wonderful care of their parents or their spouses.
Thank you very much, Connie, for calling. And Denise in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Denise.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm glad you're having this program. I wanted to tell you my husband has had Alzheimer's since, or however you say it, since 97. And how we found this out was his driving and his short-term memory. So when we came back, we were living down south, we came back up here, and he was tested immediately. And that's what is important, is getting the person tested. Then they know exactly where they are. What we found out was that he tried Aricept, did not work for him. It made him more anxious. They put him on Rasinine and later Namendin. Now, he has stayed pretty much the same. He's about what they'd say in the middle of the disease. He has stayed the same for a long time.
Yeah.
So he's not gotten any worse. However, he sleeps a lot.
Yeah.
Just a comment, and that is that, first of all, I think that the caller's statement that find out, don't ignore it, is very important. And if someone is experiencing progressive memory loss, especially short-term memory loss, and it's affecting their ability to drive or take care of themselves or pay the bills or whatever, don't ignore it. You need to know, needs to be evaluated. And I know that in Manitowoc, we had, there was Dr. Tracy Hoffman, who was an excellent family physician with geriatric training, who was doing evaluations in Manitowoc. And I think that the caller is a testament to the value of those kinds of evaluations.
Yeah. Thank you.
We were just lucky to have her. However, she's not here anymore, and we are looking for a physician for my husband right now. We do not have anybody that is a geriatric that will, you know, so we're in that position right now. But so far, so good.
Well, that's good. The initial news is bad about your husband, but it's good that things are working out probably as well as can be expected. Thank you again, Denise, for calling. And Dr. Sager, thank you again. For people wanting more information about the Institute or about Alzheimer's, where's a good place to go?
Well, I think, again, the website, and I can give – and first of all, the information about Alzheimer's disease, the National Alzheimer's Association has an excellent website with which will answer many questions, and that's alz.org. That's alz.org. And our website, I mentioned earlier, it's medsch.wisc.edu/WAI.
Dr. Sager, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Dr. Mark Sager is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Institute, the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Again, if you'd like to learn some more, the Alzheimer's Institute itself, that's an easy one to remember, alz.org. And the medical school is actually pretty easy, too. MEDSCH, of course, stands for med school, medsch.wisc.edu/WAI. Pleased to have him with us. And we'll certainly take another show, and probably more, to talk about Alzheimer's and keep you up to date on what's going on. Obviously, from all the calls today, and there were many we didn't get to, it's an issue that affects probably most every family at one time or another here in the state and probably across the country. Somebody you know or somebody related to is going to be in that situation. So pleased to have him with us, and Dr. Sager will be back and we'll do it again. We're going to switch gears with you now and talk about inventions and patents and trademarks and copyrights and licensing agreements. Maybe you've had a good idea once upon a time, or maybe you have, maybe you've had many good ideas that you thought it'd be great if we patented this. Well, I tell you what, there's a new book out. It's called The Independent Inventor's Handbook. And Louis Forman and Jill Gilbert Wellytalk are the authors. And Jill is going to be our guest next year, coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.